John Jeffries, Jr. is the dean of the law school at the University of Virginia. Dean Jeffries is a graduate of Yale University and earned his law degree here at Virginia, where he was editor-in-chief of the Virginia Law Review and also had the highest academic average. Now, how anybody could have both of those honors is absolutely beyond me, because being editor-in-chief of the Law Review is in itself a full-time job. And to be able to, most of my friends who were on the Law Review didn't even go to class. So the fact that John was able to have the highest academic average is indeed extremely impressive. He clerked for United States Supreme Court Justice Lewis F. Powell, Jr., and has written the definitive biography of Justice Powell. He holds two chairs here at the law school, the Emerson Spies and the Arnold H. Leon chairs, and has served as dean since the fall of 2001. Please welcome John Jeffries.
Thank you, George. With your indulgence, we're going to do this a little differently from the way panels usually work. We're going to ask our panelists to respond with extreme brevity to three questions, and the trade-off will be that they get a chance to speak several different times, even if not at length. And Peter Walston is going to join us. Peter, you can sit right here.
Sorry.
That's fine. Peter, who came in just moments ago, is spatially out of order. It's an embarrassment, given the extraordinary accomplishments represented in the panel before you, to name only one thing about each, but let me identify for you why they're here. Peter Walston was counsel to the president during the second Reagan administration. Next to him is Mike Egan. Mike was the Associate Attorney General of the United States under Judge Bell and the presidency of Jimmy Carter. And next to him is Bob Lipschitz, who was the counsel to the president under President Carter, 1977 to 1979. To his right is C. Boyden Gray, who was counsel to the first President Bush during, I think, the entirety of his time in office. And to his right, Eleanor Acheson, who was Assistant Attorney General, Office of Policy Development under President Clinton. And finally, at the end, barely hanging on to the table, is my friend and former student, David Leach, who was deputy counsel to the current president. I'd like to ask three questions of all of our panelists. The first is simply, what was your role in these matters? And that may be that I've already said enough, but we'll see. Secondly, I suspect that their experience is going to reveal to us all not only a tug of war between the Department of Justice and the Office of the White House Counsel, but over time, a movement from one toward the other, and that's the topic on which I'd like to ask them to address secondly. And then the last question I'll pose to our panelists is whether the process of judicial selection at this point in our nation's history seems to be working well, or whether it's broken, and if it is broken, how can we fix it? Let's start, Peter, with you, since you're here. You were in the White House counsel the second Reagan administration. What was your role in judicial selection?
I thought this was supposed to be alphabetical. Okay.
This is like law school. You're supposed to speak when you're called up.
Yeah, that's right. It's like law school, exactly. I hated law school. Okay, what I wanted to say was that the Reagan administration may be different from prior administrations. I can't talk about the subsequent ones, but the Reagan administration took judicial selection very seriously. Judge candidates of various kinds were for either district courts or courts of appeals, and certainly the Supreme Court, were vetted very carefully with interviews at the Justice Department, and large and extensive dossiers were prepared about them by the FBI. And the objective here was to find two things. One is that they were judicial conservatives, as we defined it at the time, and secondly, that they were young enough to serve for a long time in positions that were life tenure. And so, as I say, this was a very conscious effort on the part of the Reagan administration to transform the judiciary in a direction of much more judicial conservatism. My role as counsel to the president was to chair the final meeting in which the Justice Department and the various other people with interests in this subject were given the opportunity to make their pitch for particular candidates, to talk about what were the strengths and the weaknesses of these candidates, and then finally to decide. And we did this, we never did it by a vote, we did it finally by consensus. It was really possible for someone who objected very strongly to in effect stop a nomination at that level, but to make a decision about whether to go forward with the nomination to the president. I also had another role in addition to participating as kind of the chair of that process. I also made independent judgments looking at FBI reports and other material that was developed about the people who were candidates, about whether whether Ronald Reagan would be proud to make the nomination. I think Reagan, I was quite careful with all the nominees, but particularly with the judicial nominees because they were life tenure, to make sure that none of them ever embarrassed, to the extent that you could do it, never embarrassed Ronald Reagan. And so I frequently found in the material that was supplied cases where people had done things. This was frequently the case in FBI reports. People had done things that did not seem quite right. And if they had come to light in the course of the process of congressional review, might have been embarrassing to the president. And those never went forward. There were some cases where it was really it was on the cusp. It might be acceptable. It might not be acceptable. And what we did in that case is we sent one of the lawyers from my office up to the Hill to talk to the chairman and the ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee and to explain, without giving them the White House, actual White House document, describe to the senator what the problem is and get a reaction, a political reaction to how things would develop on the Hill. And if the reaction was, well, that really won't be a problem, we can take care of that, then the nomination went forward. If they said, well, I don't like the sound of this, the nomination could have been turned back. Now, I want to talk about two Supreme Court nominations because they're pretty interesting. One was the Rehnquist nomination, as I mentioned in the last panel. Bill Rehnquist, if any of you know him, was one of the nicest, sweetest, most approachable people you can imagine. Very, very low-key guy, almost shy, and very lawyerly. I mean, he thought in terms of the way a lawyer thinks. He had no political, I don't want to say no political sense, he just wasn't politically adept. He didn't think in these terms. And we knew when he was going to be nominated for chief that the issue with him was going to be his views on Brown versus Board of Education. And so I went to talk with him. I had several meetings with him to kind of prepare him for this. We did not do a murder board for him, of course, because he was already a sitting justice of the Supreme Court, and it didn't seem appropriate. But I did go to talk to him and kind of interview him about these issues. And he, and I asked him how he would respond to a question about Brown. And he gave me a perfectly reasonable, lawyerly answer, citing Plessy and why Plessy was modified and Brown reversed it and so forth. And it was very much like the answer that he had given when he was first up for Associate Justice. And I said to him, you know, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, you must realize and speak of this as though it is a moral issue. It's not just a legal issue, it's a moral issue. So you have to have a certain amount of passion in what you are going to say about Brown. And he listened and nodded and so forth. I didn't know whether he took it seriously, but when he did get to testify about Brown, he did put into it some of the things that I think satisfied a lot of the people about where his heart really was. And so that's another thing that I think counsel to presidents can do in the process of judicial nominations, where there's a particularly difficult one. You have a perspective that can make things better in terms of providing judges with a sense of what their real audience is. It's not just the lawyers. It's not just the lawyers sitting on the Senate Judiciary Committee, it is the country at large. And one might argue in the case of the Bork nomination that is something that was missed. Because when Bob Bork spoke about the privacy question, which got him into a lot of difficulty, he didn't talk about it in the terms in which I think most ordinary people think about privacy. He spoke about it purely in terms of constitutional terms and law. And that, I think, got him into a certain amount of difficulty. And if he had, in fact, had a murder board, which he didn't, but if he'd had one, and he had answered the question in that context, I think many of the people who were there, I was not there for the Bork nomination, would have helped him understand how he should have answered the privacy question. One other point about the Scalia nomination. We took part jointly with the Justice Department in reviewing the candidates to take Rehnquist's place when Rehnquist was taking Berger's place as Chief Justice. And at first, the Justice Department started on this effort, but it was taking an awfully long time, and we were somewhat afraid that the confidentiality that this thing had at the time, nobody knew about the fact that there was a Supreme Court opening coming up. And we wanted to keep it that way. We wanted to announce it and not have a lot of controversy associated with it before we announced it. And so the time was running on. Nothing was coming out of the Justice Department. And so I asked some of my associate counsels to start reviewing the records of the Court of Appeals judges who were then the candidates. There were four or five of them. And Bork and Scalia were two. They came out on top. We went to the president and we gave him a list with a pretty complete description of each of them. And the president looked at this list, and he turned to me and he said, "Is Scalia of Italian extraction? Is he Italian American?" And I said, "Yes, Mr. President, he is." And he says, "That's the man. That's the man." So all of our efforts, all we had to do really was just put in a name, but. That's what the president wanted. He very much wanted to nominate the first Italian American to the Supreme Court, just as he had nominated the first woman, and so it was all over. There were many of us who had speculated maybe we ought to start with Bork, and if we get another opportunity, we'll go with Scalia next because he's very likely to get that nomination. He's likely to be approved. Bork is going to be tougher. So let's get that through when it's not quite as meaningful. When you get to that next nomination, that's going to be very tough, and we'll put up Scalia at that time, but the president would have none of it. He wanted to make sure that during his presidency, wasn't sure about the future, during his presidency, he knew he had an opportunity to appoint the first Italian-American, and he went ahead and did it. Thank you.
Mike Egan, the view from the Department of Justice in the Carter administration.
Let me first make a comment about Lloyd Cutler. I was fortunate enough to know Lloyd because Lloyd made it his business to know everybody of any importance in Washington. That's where he made his first mistake, as far as I know, because I was not at all important. That gets around to my role in judicial selection. I had served as minority leader in the Georgia House when Jimmy Carter was governor. That means I'm a Republican. So the question arises, well, how the hell did you get appointed to be Associate Attorney General by Jimmy Carter? Well, Jimmy was a friend of mine. That's pure and simple how it happened, as was Griffin Bell, and the fact that they wanted the Justice Department to be free of any taint of political activity. Remember, we came on right after Watergate. Attorney General Levy was in between John Mitchell and Griffin Bell, and he tried, but he wasn't there very long. So the president and Griffin Bell wanted to keep the department out of politics. So have a Republican deal with judicial appointments. That's a good step. And he'll have to deal with the senators and so forth, which I did on problems. And that wasn't always easy. Of course, being a Republican wasn't always easy in that administration either. I remember walking up the steps to the Justice Department behind a couple of the young people in there, and what that conversation was going, how the hell did that guy get appointed Associate Attorney General? And he's a Republican. Well, I didn't bother to inform them that I was a decent guy and a good lawyer. But anyhow, my role in the, of course, I think that the Justice Department during the Carter administration had the primary job of handling judicial appointments. We, unlike your administration, had no Supreme Court appointments to make, so it got pretty routine. We had just a number of appellate and, of course, a lot of district court judges. On the district court judges, the senators played a major role, particularly if they were Democrats. We had some problems in Pennsylvania, which at that time had two Republican senators, and that made sort of a little problem here and there. But what we did was we'd get the word. I guess it came from the administrative office of the courts that a justice had died and or taken senior status, and we had a vacancy. We would then turn to the senators and others in the state that knew if it was a district court. On the appellate level, President Carter caused to be appointed committees of citizens to make recommendations to the department and to him, really, as to who should be appointed. And these committees would come up with four or five names if it was an appellate judge. In the case of district court judges, we encouraged senators to use committees of citizens to give them advice on who they should recommend to the president for appointment. Some senators did it, some did not. But all of the appellate ones, the senators didn't appoint these committees, the White House did, with help from those of us in the Justice Department. And they were largely political in nature. These appointees were people who had worked for the president in his campaign and who were prominent in the Democrat Party in their particular states. Well, we'd get recommendations that would come in from them. There'd be four or five names. We'd I would sit down and go over these names with Judge Bell, who would decide which one he would favor. We would send all these names to the president. And when I say send them, we sent them via Griffin Bell, who took them to the president. Now, as far as I know, Bob Lipschutz is here. He can tell you. Maybe he got to the president through Bob, but I asked Griffin before I got up here. I said, now, Griffin, when you left the department and went over, did you go to the president or did you go to Mr. Lipschutz? Hell, Mike, you know better than that. I went to the president. But I suspect we had gotten advice from Bob and Margaret McKenna and Mr. Cardoza, who was up here earlier, and others in the council's office. You know, the phones were ringing all the time, but somebody said there was some rule that the only message to go to the Justice Department from the White House was through the council. Well, if that was a rule in the White House, it was violated frequently. And we heard from a lot of people over there and took all of these advices into consideration. We heard from a lot of senators. And then Griffin would go over with our recommendation. If it was a district court judge, it really didn't, we didn't have much choice because a senator pretty well had the last word on that, because if you didn't appoint the guy the senator wanted, he wouldn't get confirmed, and that was few and simple. That was it. There was, I don't remember the color of the slips, but there's something about a blue slip in the justice, in the Judiciary Committee, and they wouldn't even get a hearing. But anyhow, Bob will tell you what happened with these appointments when they got over to the White House, but most of the time, after we had done our work, which consisted of pretty good investigation, Griffin knew a lot of people around the country, as did I. We had a lot of friends out there. The president would accept the recommendation we made. Now, there were times, at one time I remember, that he did not, and it was because this was a circuit court. I forget whether it's the 10th or the 8th, whatever one Utah is in. One of the senators was being reluctant about the Panama Canal Treaty, and the president did not see any reason to offend that senator by not selecting his choice, who was the number two man as far as Griffin and I were concerned. The president appointed someone on the list. Well, he appointed the number two man, and it was Griffin and I had recommended someone else. That's about the only time I remember that the name that went from the Justice Department to the White House was not appointed. After the nomination, well, before the nomination, after the presidential selection, that's when the American Bar Association and the FBI would do their investigations. We always waited for those before the president made the nomination. Sometimes those reports would cause problems. The ABA every now and then would say the person we thought we wanted or that the senator wanted was not qualified. The FBI said about one person a lot worse things than that, and also said nobody is to know about this, which caused a lot of problems. Griffin decided, well, we had to let Senator Stevenson know. And who had that job? I had to go over and tell Senator Stevens about it. Stevenson, I'm sorry. And that was generally my role in judicial selection, was dealing with the senators and keeping the process moving, at least insofar as the Justice Department was concerned. And we thought we sort of ran the judicial selection. Now, Bob Lipschutz here is going to tell you he really ran it, but we don't know. We don't believe that. Thank you.
Bob, you're on.
Thank you, Mike. Mike and I are very friendly. He was my state senator for many years before we came to Washington. Once President Carter went into office, he housed the primary responsibility, as Mike said, in the Justice Department. But I do say primary because he also put some of the responsibility in our office to work with the Justice Department. Particularly, he wanted our office to work on the affirmative action aspect of his appointments. He was determined to increase substantially the number of women and minorities on the bench. There were very, very few, and I don't mean just Supreme Court, which it wasn't even involved, but I mean the district courts and the circuit courts. For instance, when Carter went to office, there was one woman on the appeals courts and five women on among all the district courts, and even less minorities. Before the president actually went into office, but after his election, of course, he and Attorney General Bell met with Senator Eastland, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and worked out an agreement with him, a compromise, in order to modify the previous method of getting appointments made. At the district court level, they all agreed they would leave that primary function to the senators, as Mike said, provided, of course, they were in the Democratic Party. But at the circuit court level, they agreed that the president would appoint committees in every circuit where there was a pending appointment, a committee to screen recommendations, and to put particular emphasis on the appointment of women and minorities. And this was done in every single circuit before appointments were ever submitted. And after they came up with a list of five people, they were submitted to the Justice Department, which, as Mike has explained, screened to make sure that these people were qualified, and then submitted with a recommendation of usually two people to be picked from by the president. During the first year or so of the administration, before the enactment of the Onerous Judgeship Law, there were a small number of appointments, but these committees came up with no recommendations for women and minorities. But once the Omnibus Judgeship Act was put in place, then we all took aggressive action to try to insist that these committees bring in women and minorities, and at the appellate court level. And that proved to be quite successful, and the reason it was is because, as Mike has alluded, before the inauguration, Griffin and the president met with Senator Eastland and worked out this compromise. And it was absolutely essential, because without this change, the president's hands would have been tied to the old system of letting the senator control all appointments. So after the enactment of this act, these committees were appointed, citizens' committees, to make recommendations, and these recommendations would come to the Attorney General. But we noticed that early on that we were still getting very few women and very few minorities suggested. And the president asked Judge Bell why we weren't doing any better. And he explained that the American Bar Association Standing Committee had their standards and in two particular aspects that were really limiting the number who were even available under those regulations, under those guidelines. One of these, that a lawyer had to be in practice at least 13 years before even being considered. And the second was that the lawyer had to have extensive trial experience. Well, I think as we look back on the bar lawyers in those days, there were very few women and very few minorities who could meet those two standards. The number of women was infinitesimal in the law, in the legal profession, and a very small number of minorities. And also, even those who were in, particularly among women, had only been practicing for short periods of time in most cases. So the pool of available candidates under the standing committee's requirements eliminated a possibility of making any progress. And so the president had me go to speak with the standing committee. And frankly, we just had to be rather blunt and tell them that if they did not cooperate with us by modifying these requirements, then we would start ignoring the standing committee and the American bar and go directly to the process. They did modify the requirements, and in such a manner that from then on, we did get significant recommendations of women and minorities. And as a result of all this, by the time the president left office, after the enactment of the Omnibus Judgeship Act, the number of both women and minorities had substantially, dramatically increased over what it had been when President Carter went in office. And as a result of it, we had no appointments to the Supreme Court, but we were very pleased that that was the ultimate result of this policy of appointments. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Warden Gray?
To try to answer the three questions, the role that the White House counsel played during Bush 41 was basically the same, I think, as what Peter has described. We inherited the model from the Reagan White House. I don't think it was much different. I do think, because I did a lot of work with David and his crew, that we did less than they now do in the White House counsel's office. We did not have the manpower, the people. We only had, I think, eight commissioned officers and two or three detailees. And we just did not have the manpower to do all the research, and we didn't. And when it came to the fight with over Justice Thomas, we wouldn't have the manpower to have lobbied it. We had to have the department for that as well. But it worked very well. I don't remember. I remember a couple of, you know, pretty tough disagreements, but there was nothing really tense. And if time permits, I could tell an anecdote about my one real disagreement with Attorney General Thornburg, but it wasn't over judges. Part of the problem, part of the reason for this, I think, is that we more or less told him who he was going to appoint to his key posts, including one of the gentlemen who's sitting in the audience right now, who headed the office that, in our case, was OLC as opposed to OLP in the Reagan years, Bill Barr. We were all friends. It was just not going to be a difficult circumstance. That is not to say that the Thomas fight wasn't a difficult circumstance. It was certainly the most difficult thing I've ever been through. But again, the department was in it completely up to its eyeballs, as we were up to ours. I gather now, and you'll hear this from David, that the system may have changed, but that's the way it was in our day. Is the system now broken? Just to remind people, we had a Democratic Senate and got two nominees through. It is often said that Souter was a stealth nominee and was snuck through, but he actually quite a bit was known about him, enough so that there were some interest groups putting out flyers that said women will die if he is confirmed. He was not thought to be someone who would vote in the pattern that he's now voting, and there is some scholarship that's going to come out. Jan Greenberger has a book underway where I think she's going to show that his voting pattern changed after Thomas went on the bench. I can't speak to that in terms of the cases, but that's what some people think. In any event, we were able to get both nominees through a Democratic Senate, and had they wanted to put a very kindly end to Justice Thomas without putting the country through what the country went through, they could have filibustered him. and they didn't. And that was, to me, always proof that they didn't think they had the filibuster until they invented it for judges in 2003. And that, of course, remains still controversial. Is the system broken? Well, I don't think so, but it's a good deal more difficult now than it was even when we had the Thomas fight.
Thank you, Board. Eleanor Acheson.
Thank you. In the Clinton administration, the structure was very much the counsel of the president was the field marshal of the judicial appointments process. And my thinking about it, preparation for this, and thinking back on my experience was that that person in that position really had four big assignments. The counsel setting up the structure and systems, i.e. getting the people in the White House working for him, who could do the White House end of it, which in the administration was the reaching out to senators for candidates and dealing with the senators and the Hill when we didn't have senators, which was regrettably all too much of the time, for other matters, getting the system set up in the White House, fighting for judicial appointments to be a priority issue with the chief of staff and the staff secretary, which is very, very important. There were times when we did not have our eye on that ball, and we waited months to have memos get into the president and weeks to have nominations papers get in and get out, which was a very frustrating thing. But the setting up the structure and the systems and fighting for them within the White House, focusing, because he as the field marshal was the ultimate guarantor of this, focusing very much on the quality of appointments. And if there were, as Peter talked about, the transformational sort of goals of the administration he worked in, transformational goals of President Clinton's administration was diversity with maintaining the very highest level of excellence, and so we had our focus on that. The council, it seems to me, also had responsibility to make sure the president's prerogatives in the context of judicial appointments were really vigorous and muscular, particularly given the constitutional nature of the responsibilities and the rights and the prerogatives themselves as they've been traditionally understood, and the fact that it was plain after the 80s into the 90s that judicial appointments were beginning to emerge as a matter with major policy and political implications. The role of the Department of Justice in this picture from the perspective of the counsel of the president was, at least on paper starting out, I think much more focused on being the workhorse in evaluating candidates. And so we were more tied to the quality of appointments piece of this. It pretty quickly, and I think the main focus in the beginning was the district court candidates, many more, obviously. And the idea was the White House would do the Supreme Court candidates and maybe most, if not all, of the Court of Appeals candidates. It quickly developed that, as Boyden Gray just mentioned, that their resources were really not there in the White House, particularly at the beginning, because the transition had been slow. There was a massive amount of appointment work to do, and a whole clutch of that that could be taken and put right over in the Justice Department were the judicial appointments. So I was the Assistant Attorney General responsible for managing this work from the department's perspective, and I had you couldn't have a better partner as far as someone with experience, work ethic, and relationships on the Hill to execute the president and the council's end of this in Ron Klain. And Ron and I quickly worked out that we would do virtually work on not only all the district court candidates, but also any overflow, which turned out to be a lot, for circuit court candidates. We did have a system that we had weekly meetings, as Judge Mikva referred to, with a judicial selection committee there. I think we worked very, very well, excuse me, particularly in the first term, as basically one team. We did have struggles over the the issue of quality of appointments. I thought of the Department of Justice roles to make sure, you know, people who weren't qualified didn't get through, but also to fight as affirmatively as I knew how to for the best candidate. Now, in the district court, you have a situation where only one candidate is really sent forward, and it's only until, you know, when you bounce that candidate that in our system you got a shot at a second person. But with respect to the Court of Appeals people with whom we'd gotten our hooks in, we being the Department of Justice, because we were doing all the work on evaluating multiple candidates, I didn't ask permission. I just showed up and would be arguing for the merits of the person I thought was the best candidate. Judge Mikva said earlier that, you know, if I said somebody wasn't qualified, then they didn't get through. He was the man that basically made that happen. We had a bit of a bumpy time before Judge Mikva got to be the counsel of the president. We never had a real showstopper. We always worked through controversies over qualifications, and actually the department prevailed in virtually every occasion until the occasion that was waiting on Judge Mikva's desk until he got there, which had all of a sudden started to involve, because of demographic issues and a lot of things, not just people in the counsel's office, but half the White House staff somehow had gotten involved in this. We absolutely need to go forward with this person, with the Justice Department saying we absolutely cannot go forward with this person. And I tell you, it was the happiest day of my life as I was contemplating what's the point of being in this job if you can't have a say of, you know, who should go forward about issues like this. The phone rang, and I think it was the first or second day Judge Mikva was in his position, and I picked it up. And he said, "LD, this is Ab Mikva. X will not be a federal judge." And I thought, God, you know, the heavens had opened. This was great. He cut through it right away, as only he could have, having been a federal judge himself with a perspective of the bench. Thereafter, we were at the department doing extremely well. When Judge Mikva left, we did have some issues, and Bruce Lindsay, who was the deputy counsel of the president all the way through and a member of the judicial appointments panel, and I often had discussions, because often, these were not wildly frequent events, but when we had problems, in many cases the problems were with people who the president knew and wanted to appoint because of political connections and friendships and so forth, or somebody else high up in the White House. And Bruce, we'd get to this issue of, would this embarrass the president? And Bruce would say, well, how can you possibly answer that? I know what would embarrass the president. I'm telling you, this would not embarrass the president. So I used to take the position that we had two concerns here. We had the president and we had the courts. And I was going to stand up for the courts. And so if this person didn't embarrass the president, he or she was sure going to embarrass the court. And we managed to, I think, get the right thing done. There were some interesting things. One time we said no, which we, the Justice Department, to a candidate for district court position from a rural state, plain state, rural area of a plain state. Not a state I would have thought the president politically would have spent a lot of time in. Bruce was not happy about this because it implicated and upset another constituency that picketed the White House and all sorts of stuff, got very upset about it. We went through it. We did it. About 3 years later, just totally out of the blue, at the end of a meeting, a judicial appointments meeting, Bruce said to me, you know, the president was recently in X city of Y state, and Z came up to him and chatted with him. It was some kind of a fundraiser. And the president said afterward to Bruce, "You tell LD Acheson, I think she was just dead wrong. That guy would have made a great federal judge." So every time we had a discussion afterward, Bruce would raise this story about quality and appointments. But that was effectively the role of the Department of Justice. The second term, I ran into Fred Fielding very soon after the reelection and on the street, actually, right at the top of Lafayette Square. And I remember him saying to me, "It's all downhill from here." And man, was he right. It became very, very tough. The Justice Department got very much more involved in pushing the counsel's office to deal with personnel issues. We only had one blip, but it was at a critical time when somebody was put into the associate counsel position who, wonderful person, wonderful lawyer, zero experience with the Senate, zero experience with federal judges, zero knowledge about the process, combined with zero interest. And this fell at a time when we also had, we'd lost massive numbers of Democratic senators, we had massive numbers of Republican senators, many of whom were dead set against the president getting very many more candidates appointed. And at that point, I just felt that I needed a Hail Mary here. I went to John Podesta, who'd become the chief of staff, and for better or for worse, the chief of staff's office got immediately very involved with judicial appointments. The individual who'd been handling this role was gone about 2 days later, and somebody else was brought in who had tremendous amount of experience and the confidence of both the counsel and the chief of staff. They really plumped up the office over there, and we got rolling again with a staff and with a process and with a political commitment for people to go to the Hill. And at that point, the Justice Department had gotten more involved with that aspect. And really, in the second term, I went along with Mark Childress, who had that role, a lot to the Hill, doing more discussion about candidates and working out deals, which essentially we now had to do with the chair of the Judiciary Committee, but also with home state senators, Republicans in very powerful positions. But it was very uphill work. But that was the function of the department. It was largely to do the vetting and manage that whole process. We probably vetted close to 450 people. Notwithstanding the travails of the second term, we got 378 federal judges appointed, 370 of whom were Article III judges, and a tremendous level of ABA high ratings and tremendous diversity, and it, I think, really an excellent result, notwithstanding some of the challenges.
Thank you, LD. David Leach.
Thank you. I was a little reluctant to appear on a panel given that I served in the current administration, but a couple of things I should note. One is, of course, I served under Judge Gonzalez, and so my experience is not necessarily current anymore. Secondly, since the Senate changed this week, I have a feeling that to the extent it was current, it's about to be modified. So this is probably at most of historical interest, like many of the others on the panel. But I did serve in the White House in the first term after Tim Flanagan was there the first 2 years. I became deputy counsel to the president halfway through the first term and served into the beginning of the second term. In that time period, the White House, I would say, while working very collaboratively with the Justice Department, and it was a collaborative effort, the primary person who was giving advice to the president on judicial selection was Judge Gonzalez as the White House counsel. And I think this harkens back to something that we touched on this morning, which is the personal relationship of the White House counsel to the president. And in this case, that personal relationship had gone back a number of years in Texas when Judge Gonzalez was counsel to the governor, served as Secretary of State, was appointed to the Texas Supreme Court by Governor Bush, and was just somebody that the president, still remains somebody the president trusts implicitly and who understands the president and the way he thinks. So from the beginning of the administration, Judge Gonzalez was the architect of judicial selection, working on a judicial selection committee with General Ashcroft and people like Viet Dinh from the Office of Legal Policy, and then their successors, to run people through the process. I'll tell you a little bit about the process and my role in it. One of the interesting things that we always faced was the initial question of who gets to be interviewed, which of course is a necessary step in the process, and the senators had all sorts of reasons for having us interview all sorts of people, some of which were serious candidates and some of which thought it would be neat to come to the West Wing and spend a few hours with some folks in the council's office. So we had to exercise at least some control over that process. And we took the same approach that I think has been referenced here earlier, which is for Court of Appeals judges, the president and the counsel to the president and the attorney general very much viewed it as more of something that was a prerogative of the president to make sure that he picked somebody that was somebody that he thought was the right person for the job, with much less influence by the senators over that process. Now, the senators didn't necessarily agree with that position, so of course they always tried to have people come in. But we made it clear from the beginning that a Court of Appeals seat was something that the president was going to exercise a lot more discretion over. For the district court, we insisted from the beginning of the administration, and I think this has continued to this day, that senators send up three names for each vacancy, and that we would interview the three people that the senators sent to us. And again, particularly particularly Republican senators or some other political lead in the state, a Republican governor or some other person who knew the state particularly well. And we would interview three people that the senator sent us and maybe add a few more based on particular circumstances. But the test that we applied, senators, of course, were not bashful in telling us who they preferred. But the test that we applied to the senators, preferred choice was what we used to refer to as an above the bar, below the bar test, which basically, if the senator expressed an interest in a particular person on the list of three, if we concluded that they were above the bar, this mythical bar of qualification, then we would, even though they weren't necessarily the person that we would have chosen, left to our own devices, we would defer to the senator. We got into these interesting discussions about people who were scraping the paint off the top of the bar, but we nevertheless tried to observe this line of somebody that was within the realm to which we should defer to a senator, or somebody that we just really didn't feel was qualified or otherwise would serve the courts, the country, the president well. And so that was the process for deciding who got interviewed, and then once they came in, sort of what we would do coming out of the interviews. I participated in all the interviews. We usually had, for the Court of Appeals, we had the counsel to the president, myself, a representative of the Justice Department, and an associate counsel. For the district court, it tended to be me and an associate counsel and a representative of the Justice Department doing the interviews, and we would obviously report into the Judicial Selection Committee, and had a very, a very collaborative process, much like has been described. We operated by consensus. There were one difference from what I heard Judge Mikva describe this morning was there was no representative of the First Lady's office on our Judicial Selection Committee. But other than that, I think we had representatives of all the offices that you mentioned this morning. We did operate by consensus. I'll share with you one story when things got a little out of hand, believe it or not, over a tax court judge, which was not something that we would have ordinarily spent a lot of time talking about. Tax court judges are appointed for a term of, I believe it's 15 years, and there was apparently a presumption before we came into office that a tax court judge whose term was up was sort of presumptively entitled to be reappointed. Well, there were some people in the White House who thought that if their term was 15 years, their term was 15 years, and we ought to have some say in who their successor was, and if they were qualified and ready to serve another 15 years, that was all well and good, but we weren't going to necessarily just defer to somebody who'd been appointed 15 years ago to a 15-year term. In one particular case, this became an issue between Karl Rove and Josh Bolton, who was the head of OMB at the time, and they had their own particular reasons, one wanting somebody to be reappointed and one wanting to be able to bring in somebody who hadn't been a tax court judge. I'll let you sort of infer for yourself which one would wanted which preference. But we had a discussion in the counsel's office, in Judge Gonzalez's office, that ended in a playful but nonetheless a wrestling match between Karl Rove and Josh Bolton to determine which judge was going to be appointed. It wasn't determinative, but they did have a fun time on the floor of the counsel's office pretending to wrestle each other to see who would get this this judge appointed. But most of the time, the meetings were not that lively, but we did have good discussions that included everything from qualifications to political interests to, you know, senators, to diversity, to what the ABA might say. And more on that in just a second. Once we made the determination of who we would recommend to the president, we then had a smaller meeting in the Oval Office with the president, with the counsel of the president and myself and associate counsels who were responsible for the particular seat that was at issue. And we would go through a description with the president of the person that we were proposing to be appointed, of their qualifications. He would ask questions, sometimes about qualifications, sometimes about who else we had looked at, what the profile was of the people that we had looked at. He would ask, maybe he knew somebody in the state, and did we consider this person? Perhaps sometimes he knew the governor well. In one particular state, he knew the governor very well, and he was always interested in what the governor of Florida thought. But we had good discussions about the candidates, and then the person was approved to be nominated. At that point, we moved into the FBI background investigation, and this is where things diverged a little bit from previous history, because in the past, the White House had always given the ABA committee the name at the same time that it was going to the FBI, or at least before the nomination. I'm not sure what the progression was, but early in this administration, the White House made the decision not to give the ABA that special or favored role, and to instead to let the ABA look at the nominee after the nomination, just like every other group that that might have an interest in a nomination. That put a lot more pressure on the FBI background investigation, because we didn't have an independent group that might go out and find things that the FBI didn't find, and or that would exercise some sort of opinion or their view of quality of the nominee. So we were operating a little bit more in the dark than perhaps some of the earlier administrations in terms of the people that we nominated. But I think the record shows that it's worked out pretty well. There haven't been a lot of hiccups in terms of the ABA process, which now continues after the nomination. The last part of the process is that I would get back the FBI background report and would read the background report, cover to cover, and see if there were any issues that we had not previously been made aware of. The time when we would previously have been made aware of the issues would have been at the end of the interview, when it was the case that it fell to me usually to ask everyone else but the nominee or the prospective nominee to leave the room, in which case I would have what we call the sex and drugs and rock and roll discussion, which was basically, tell me everything that you've ever done that you don't want to tell me that you've ever done. And we had a series of questions about drug use and, extramarital affairs, arrests, boy, I can't remember the list, but nannies, taxes, it went on and on. And we tried to smoke out at that point anything that might come up in the FBI report. And obviously if we did and we decided it was an issue, we wouldn't move forward. That was a hard thing to explain to senators sometimes, because I think, as someone alluded to earlier, those reports are confidential. I remember getting chewed out by Senator Specter on a couple of occasions for not telling him the reason why I was rejecting the person who had contributed to his campaign for so many years. But anyway, that was the sort of final step in the process, to look at the FBI background report, and those sometimes presented interesting issues for which there was no set answer. Is this someone that, do they meet some test? You have to use judgment, and we occasionally got into discussions with the president about, whether this was an issue that he thought was disqualifying. So that was how it worked, at least earlier in this administration.
David, thank you very much. I confess I'm disappointed to learn that rock and roll is a no-no. I guess my chances have just gone by the board. One of the things that occurs to me, our time is virtually gone, but I ask whether anyone has parting shots on this theme. One thing that occurs to me, if you think of the federal judiciary in three levels, the occasional and naturally extraordinarily high-profile appointment to the Supreme Court of the United States, the courts of appeal, which are extremely important and which do not have the deep tradition of senatorial courtesy, and the district court judges. As recently as President Ford appointed Justice Stevens, I believe it to be true that that decision was made without substantial participation outside the Department of Justice, made by the Attorney General, and made on grounds that seemed to him primarily professional. And that was at the Supreme Court. And now we have a regime in which not only is the Supreme Court nominee naturally deeply important to every White House counsel, but that the interest of the White House extends even down into the district court appointments, as David has described, asking for a list of three rather than simply accepting the senatorial nominee. Seems to me that insofar as one can generalize, there has been a movement of effective authority toward the White House. Let me just ask, from the point of view of people who actually know, do you think that's right? David, let's start with you and come to reverse order. Do you think it's accurate to say there has been a large, although slow, shift of effective political initiative to the White House from the Department of Justice and from the senators?
I certainly think there's been a shift from the senators toward, you know, more administration input at the Court of Appeals and district court level, although for the district court, the senators still have the overwhelming say in who gets appointed. I guess I hear more than a shift. I hear that the job has expanded sufficiently that there are more people involved. Some of them happen to be at the White House. Some of them happen to be at the Justice Department. I would say, you know, the Office of Legal Policy in this administration works very hard on the confirmation process and on the screening initially. So it really, to me, is collaborative. When I was in OLC, when Boyden was the White House counsel, we had a judicial selection committee that included people like John Roberts. It happened to meet at the Justice Department, but that, you know, we met at the White House in this. I don't think that really made a difference.
LD, do you have a perspective on this question?
Well, it certainly seems to me that the function has gravitated clearly to the White House, and I don't see it going back to the Justice Department as it had been in the early part of the history that we've explored today. I certainly don't see going back to that, and I actually think that is totally appropriate given the nature of the function here and the way historically I think it, as has been described, these administrations, within these different administrations, the Justice Department and the White House have worked largely well together. But I do think there's tension. There's a lot of tension sort of on the quality side when you move toward some of the interests that are reflected in the White House process. So that has to be policed. And that's something people have to keep their eye on, because it's not just a, you know, Jack Webb thing, the facts, ma'am, just the facts, you know, the merits, ma'am, just the merits. Other things come into it necessarily when you get to the White House, and you have to fight to keep the quality up sometime. And the other thing I would say is that, it's important, it seems to me, given the nature of the function and the historical prerogatives, that the president, that the council, and the help the president defend his and someday her prerogatives with respect to the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals. Not crazily, but I do think that's important. And in the Clinton administration, that was not done consistently, and part of it was the nature of the man who was president. And Boyden told a story at lunch about that, and we saw some of that happening all the time with lesser levels than the Supreme Court. But the other function is, you know, of the president wanting to talk to all sorts of people and bringing them into the process and changing his mind, and then, you know, you're way away from his being able to say this is the way it's going to be. But the other aspect of that is there a Senate that is of the president's party, and are those senators willing to accommodate the president's prerogative? And we struggled with that, not very successfully in the second term of the Clinton administration, as far as the president's pure prerogative on Court of Appeals judges. And I think one thing that will be interesting, as David alluded to, is to see what will happen in the next Congress of the Bush administration, although the Democrats are not that far in the majority, but it'll be very interesting to see.
Can I interrupt? As far as the shift from Justice Department to the Office of Legal Counsel, I mean to the President's Counsel, it all depends on the personalities. If the Justice Department is led by a former appellate court judge who is respected nationally, such as Griffin Bell was, the power is going to stay in the Justice Department. On the other hand, if Ab Mikva is running the White House counsel, it'll shift to the White House. It's going to depend and depend on the president also, where the president wants it. And he's going to want it where his friends, his closest friend is, who is also able to advise him on Senate relations and who's going to get through the Senate. One of the questions was, should we change the system? The system will work all right. I think it's going to work better now that we have a Democrat Senate and a Republican president, perhaps, than it worked before. I'm hopeful that the president is going to be reasonable about who he appoints and not send up a name of somebody who knows is going to be a lightning rod for opposition. And the Senate needs to act the same way. They need to recognize that the president is a Republican, is likely to nominate Republicans, but there are a lot of Republicans who are good lawyers and who would make fine judges. And the Senate just needs to recognize that. And I think that perhaps they will, because it's essential to the process that we get rid of this strong partisanship that we've had demonstrated in the country over the past 2 or 3 years. Because nothing's going to work right if we keep that up, I don't think. If we get rid of that, I think the process is okay. It doesn't need any changing. Thank you.
I may have to inject a little disagreement. But your question really is at two levels. I mean, you could ask, I'm sorry Bill Barr just left, but Jamie Gorelick, I hope she's still, you could ask, why have a White House counsel at all for any issue, judges or any other issue? And it just so happens that it's grown in importance, as we've heard today, and we'll hear tomorrow. And it's not going to go back to the Justice Department. Judges aren't going to go back any more than anything else is going to go back, in my opinion. And judges are no different. Now, there are probably additional reasons why the president's now making these decisions. And that has to do with an issue which, up until your question and Attorney General or Deputy Attorney Egan's answer, has sort of not been brought out, but I feel as though I must confront it, or we must confront it, although there isn't time really to do it. But that is, what's the role of ideology in the picking of a judge? And, you know, there really weren't hearings up until fairly recently. Senator Kennedy, when he introduced Justice Marshall, said there will be no questions of Judge Marshall. He was a Second Circuit judge. There were really no hearings, and there had been a lot of rejection of Supreme Court nominees for political grounds over the years, but it was done on a straight vote. It wasn't the kind of campaign you now see. And this question of ideology is relevant to this conference, because Lloyd and I testified together. I'm sure that Chuck Schumer fired the staffer who didn't do the due diligence on Cutler on the role of ideology, because he agreed that the president, elected by all the people, has the right to pick a judge he wants, and the Senate ought to confirm if the judge or the nominee is qualified and not reject on ideological grounds. This infuriated Schumer, but it gave me great pleasure, of course. Lloyd also believed and had published that the filibuster was totally out of bounds. He didn't think the filibuster was valid under any circumstances, but certainly not valid for judges. So I think that's something, one of the reasons why the center has gravitated is because the Judiciary Committee does have, as any other oversight committee has, a certain influence over the department that it funds or oversees. And this is an influence that committee or even the entire Senate doesn't have over a president. That's part of why a lot of this stuff migrates into the White House from the great departments, not just justice, all of them. This is a long, long discussion, but I do think that it's going to stay in the White House, and I do think that the filibuster will even with a closely divided Senate, is the only tool I think a Democrat can use to block a nominee, even when, as was the case in our case, the Senate is in Democratic hands, and because almost any nominee any president is going to put up in this circumstance is going to get some Democratic votes, and that's going to be enough in a closely divided Senate to get confirmed, unless you've said you need 60 votes rather than 50, and that's where the issue turns, and we haven't seen the end of that, and that issue turns on ideology.
It's my duty to tell you that George Gillum has walked down to the front and taken his seat in the Time's Up chair. Please join in thanking our distinguished panel.